Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the place where we take that fire hose of information you see every day and just distill it down to what you really need to know.
And today, we're definitely opening up a big file.
A huge one. It's a quiet revolution, really. We're talking about the massive financial transformation of the entire global insurance industry by private equity.
Yeah, and this isn't just, you know, some trend you read about in a boardroom memo. This is a tectonic shift. It really impacts every single policyholder, every professional listening to us right now. PE money has basically targeted insurance as its new primary engine for growth.
Okay, so before we jump into the mechanics, let's quickly define the player here. When we say private equity or PE, what are we actually talking about?
So think of them as these firms. They're called general partners, and they go out and raise these just enormous pools of capital.
From who?
From what are called limited partners. So these are massive institutional investors. We're talking state pension funds, university endowments, that kind of thing. And they typically get that money committed for about a decade.
And the mission is simple.
The mission is very simple. Buy businesses, run them much more aggressively to extract efficiency and yield, and then sell them for a massive profit within that fixed timeline.
The scale of this is...
Yeah.
It's just hard to wrap your head around.
It's staggering. By 2024, global PE assets had exploded to roughly $9.8
trillion. Trillion.
Trillion. And it's projected to hit $12 trillion within just the next 5 years.
Wow. That is just an astonishing amount of capital looking for a home. And when money like that decides to move into an industry, everything changes. So let's define our mission for you, the listener. We need to understand two things.
Mm-hmm.
First, why on earth did NPE set its sights so firmly on the stable, you know, kind of conservative world of insurance? And second, what do these aggressive new strategies actually mean for a policyholder or an agent on the ground?
Well, we have to start with the core attraction. It's something totally unique to insurance. It's called the float.
The float. The holy grail of insurance finance. Explain why this premium money is so incredibly valuable in the hands of a PE firm.
So float is just the premium money that policyholders pay in. It sits in the insurer's account for months or years, sometimes even decades, before a claim is actually paid out.
So it's basically a loan.
It is, for all intents and purposes, an interest-free loan from the policyholder to the insurance company. And, you know, traditionally, insurers were very cautious with this float. They invested it in safe, liquid government bonds, corporate bonds.
Very responsible.
Yeah.
But PE looked at that and just saw untapped yield. And this is where it gets really interesting, because the difference between that old way of investing and the new way is where hundreds of millions of dollars are made.
Exactly. Let's use a simple example. Let's say you have a big insurer with $10 billion in reserves. That's the float.
Okay, $10 billion.
Traditionally, you invest that at a very conservative 3%. That generates $300 million a year. But a PE-owned insurer comes in and completely changes that mandate. They shift a chunk of that reserve into higher-yielding, less liquid stuff. Now they're targeting, say, 7%.
So wait, the same $10 billion, the same policyholder capital, but at 7%?
Hmm.
That's $700 million a year.
That's it.
That's an extra $400 million in profit annually, just by changing where the money is parked.
It's completely transformational. And the main way they do this is by moving out of those safe bonds and into things like private credit.
This is what, exactly.
It's basically making direct loans to medium-sized companies. They're not as liquid as a bond you can trade on the market, but they offer much higher yields, that 7% or more, to make up for that illiquidity.
But isn't there a fundamental issue here? You're taking policyholder reserves money that is literally promised for future claims and moving it from 3% government bonds to 7% private credit. That feels like it's pushing the boundaries of fiduciary responsibility.
That is the essential tension of this entire model. It's a huge gamble. The PE strategy relies on the actuarial fact that, you know, most of that money won't be needed all at once.
Yeah.
But you're right. The risk profile goes way, way up. And this isn't some niche strategy. By 2024, an incredible $1.1 trillion in life and annuity assets had already been moved into these kinds of structures.
$1.1 trillion. Okay. So the float is the irresistible lure. What's the other part of the attraction, the thing that makes insurance a sort of safe harbor for them?
It's stability and predictability. Insurance has these incredibly high renewal rates, which means stable recurring revenue. For a PE fund that's locked in for 10 years, that kind of predictability is pure gold, especially when the rest of the economy gets shaky.
So that explains the why. Let's get into the how. this quiet revolution in what happens to the money once a PE firm takes over.
Yeah.
You mentioned private credit. What else is in this new playbook?
The change is really stark. You know, they move away from that old 90% bond model. We're seeing some of these PE-owned carriers go from maybe 5% in alternatives to 30%, sometimes even 40%.
40%. What's in that bucket?
Beyond private credit, you see a lot of structured securities. These are really complex debt products. You see real estate debt and also big allocations to things called collateralized loan obligations or CLOs.
CLOs. Oh. That sounds familiar and a little scary.
They are. They're complex bundles of corporate loans all packaged together. They offer high yields, sure, but their structure and the fact that you can't easily sell them makes them fundamentally different from holding, say, a U.S. Treasury bond.
Right. And these complex investments, they often don't have public ratings from the big agencies like Moody's or S&P, which brings us to this problem of ratings inflation. How does a PE firm get around having all these unrated, illiquid assets on its books?
This is where it gets really clever. It's a form of regulatory arbitrage. Because these assets are private, you're right, they don't have public ratings. So the PE-owned insurers go to smaller, specialized rating agencies to get what are called private letter ratings.
And what's the concern there?
Well, regulatory studies are starting to suggest that these private ratings might be a bit inflated, maybe more generous than what a major agency would assign to the same asset.
And what's the benefit of getting an inflated rating?
It's pure economics.
Hmm.
The rules say you have to hold a certain amount of capital against your assets based on their risk rating. If an asset gets a high rating, even a private one, the insurer has to hold less capital against it.
Which frees up more cash for the PE owner to go invest somewhere else.
Exactly. Maximizing returns, but potentially without fully covering the real underlying risk.
So they're gaming the capital requirements. If that wasn't complicated enough, there's this massive use of offshore structures, the Bermuda connection.
Oh, absolutely. If you want to see how risk gets shuffled around, you have to look at offshore reinsurance, particularly in Bermuda. This practice, it's something called opscouring, involves moving policyholder obligations and the assets backing them. We're talking $1.1 trillion by mid-2024 to these offshore affiliates.
Why Bermuda specifically?
Because the regulations there are different. They're subject to fewer U.S. constraints, which, again, allows for even more aggressive investment strategies than you could get away with in a tightly regulated state like New York. It's about finding the optimal regulatory environment to maximize your yield.
This all sounds like a disaster waiting to happen if the market really turns south. And this isn't just a theory, right? We've seen this go wrong.
Yeah.
Tell us about the human cost here.
We have. The story of PHL Variable Insurance Company is it's a devastating cautionary tale. It was acquired by Golden Gate Capital's Nassau Financial Group. They aggressively shifted about 30% of the company's assets into these less liquid investments. The company ended up facing a catastrophic $2.2 billion shortfall.
$2.2 billion. That is. That's not a rounding error. What happened to the people who thought they were buying security for their families?
Well, you look at the example of a woman named Jenny Napo. Her family had a $2 million death benefit policy. They paid into it faithfully for 17 years. But because the insurer went into what's called rehabilitation, and the assets were either frozen or illiquid, her family received only $300,000 up front.
Oh, my God.
That one story just underscores why this isn't some abstract financial headline. We are talking about life-altering consequences for people who did everything right.
That pause is important. That really defines the stakes here. Okay, let's pivot. If the carrier side is about chasing yield and taking on risk, the distribution side, the brokerages, that seems to be PE's strategy for stable, low-risk income. Let's talk about the great consolidation.
Right. Brokerages and agencies are almost perfect PE targets. They're what's called capital light. They don't need to hold billions in reserves. They just generate fees.
The high cash flow, low overhead.
Exactly. And critically, the whole agency landscape is super fragmented, which is ideal for a roll-up strategy. And since brokers don't take on underwriting risk, the regulatory burden is tiny compared to a carrier.
The pace of this roll-up is just stunning. I feel like every independent agency owner I talk to has either sold or is thinking about selling to a PE-backed platform.
The numbers absolutely back that up. Between 2017 and 2019 alone, there were 1,720 brokerage deals. PE-backed agencies were responsible for over half of them.
Over half.
55%. 952 deals. And to put that in perspective, one single platform, Acrature, completed 292 acquisitions just in that three-year period.
So how are they making their money here? It's not the float this time. It's a concept called multiple arbitrage. Break that down for us.
Multiple arbitrage is the engine for all of this. A PE firm buys a small independent agency at a relatively low valuation, say 4 or 5 times its EBITDA, its earnings.
Okay, they buy small and cheap.
Right. Then they combine dozens or hundreds of these small agencies into one massive centralized platform.
And why is the big platform suddenly worth more for each dollar of earnings?
That's the arbitrage. The bigger platform is just inherently more valuable to the next buyer. It's more diversified. It's more efficient. The PE firm justifies a much higher valuation, maybe 10 or 12 times EBITDA, by centralizing things. They standardize IT, create shared back office functions, cut redundant costs. They buy cheap, they scale up, and then they sell the whole package for a much, much higher multiple.
That makes perfect sense financially. But what does it feel like for that independent agent who sells? Like the Tom Mitchell example, successful independent agent one day, and the next he works for a massive platform.
Well, Tom and thousands of agents like him, they trade their autonomy for a big check up front. But the structure of that deal fundamentally changes everything. They're almost always subject to these really complex earnout provisions.
So their final payday depends on hitting some crazy growth targets. Mm.
Exactly. Really stringent retention and growth targets over several years. And they're bound by these ironclad non-compete agreements. They also get equity in the big platform, but it has no voting rights, and the PE firm has total control over when or if they can ever cash it out. They essentially become very highly compensated employees who are just obsessively focused on hitting those earnout numbers.
And that intense focus.
Yeah.
That's where the ethical strain comes in, right?
Yeah.
This directly impacts the professional listening to us now. If your giant bonus depends on steering business, what does that do to the whole client-first idea?
That is the conflict of interest. If an agent's massive bonus is riding on hitting a growth metric, and their platform has a preferred carrier, maybe it's a carrier affiliated with the same PE owner that offers a higher commission, the incentive is to push business that way.
Even if it's not the absolute best fit for the client.
It can happen, yeah. Even with the best intentions. The core principal client interest first gets severely tested under that kind of financial pressure.
So regulators can't be just sitting still while this whole industry gets rewired around yield and efficiency. How are the watchdogs, like the NAIC, responding?
The NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, is definitely playing catch-up, but they are responding. They developed this key watch list. It's known as the 13 considerations.
And what is that target?
It's a framework that identifies key areas of concern, things like how these companies are structured, especially the use of offshore entities, and it looks really closely at affiliated transactions.
That's where the carrier invests policyholder money into funds run by its own PE parent.
That's it. And to fight that, there are now much tougher disclosure requirements. Insurers have to be way more transparent about investments that have those private letter ratings we talked about. Yeah. And another big one is what's being called the bond definition battle.
The battle over what's a bond. Why is that so critical?
It's all about capital. Regulators are trying to change the definition to stop these complex structured products from getting the same favorable capital treatment as a traditional bond if they don't actually have the same risk profile. If they succeed, insurers would have to hold a lot more capital against them.
Which would cut into the profit margins for the PE owner.
Exactly. It would make the whole strategy less attractive.
Well, before we wrap, we should just briefly mention the other big area PE is targeting, which is the MGA space.
Yes, managing general agents. PE firms have been pouring money into MGAs, which act as these specialized underwriters between carriers and agents. This has led to an explosion of hyper-specialized programs, niche cyber insurance, cannabis, you name it.
Which can be a good thing for agents with complex clients.
It can be great, but it also means you have to do some serious due diligence on who the carriers and, more importantly, the reinsurance partners are that are actually backing that MGA's paper.
This has been a true deep dive. So to summarize for everyone listening, we've got these two huge transformations happening at the same time. On one hand, a massive roll-up and consolidation of agencies, driven by multiple arbitrage. And on the other, this quiet but super aggressive shift in how carriers invest our premium, chasing higher yields and riskier assets, often using offshore structures to do it.
And if you connect it all back, the entire PE model is based on one premise: maximizing returns while, and this is the key part, while maintaining policyholder security. That safety is the fundamental promise of insurance. The regulatory system is just scrambling to keep up with the financial innovation.
And that leads us to the final provocative thought we want to leave you with.
The real question, the one that hasn't been answered yet, is whether these aggressive investment strategies and these complex offshore structures will actually hold up under a severe prolonged market crisis. It is a massive systemic test that this newly remade insurance industry has not yet had to face.
And that is a challenging thought for anyone who's relying on long-term coverage or who's working as an agent today. Thank you for guiding us through all this. For you, the listener, maybe consider what this all means for your own carrier evaluation process the next time you place a policy or think about a merger. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.